Well, good morning, everybody. This is Lenny Lawson, the car guru, and I'm covering a subject. I probably have no qualifications whatsoever to cover this because I did very poorly in chemistry. I don't know about you, but science was not my bag. I was a social studies guy, and history. Didn't like English. Liked Spanish, though. Only 2 years of it. And I speak maybe three different sentences, and I can count to 100 in Spanish. I don't think I get any awards for that. It's not very useful at the Mexican restaurant. They don't care how far you can count. They just want to know how many tacos you want. I want tres, por favor. So that's about all I got. But I am going to talk about a chemistry thing. And are you guys familiar with the periodic table of elements? Well, that's basically got all of the known elements in the universe, I guess. And there is a group of them that are considered to be rare earth elements. And why the heck does that matter? Do you remember hearing about rare earth elements in the news and how that China has a lot of control over that? Well, they're not the only country. China seems to have control over everything these days. But we're not going to talk any more about them. They're not the only ones that have rare earth elements. And basically, it's a group of 17 different chemical elements. They basically occur together, side by side, in the periodic table. It would be rather funny to hear me try to pronounce some of these names, but there are why can't they just call them Bob's element, or this one's called Harry? I think that would be interesting. But no, they've got to have things like lanthanide, lanthanum, cerium, praseodymium, neodymium, promethium, samarium, europium. That europium, that's used a lot. That's one of those ones that gets used in a lot of different things that we use today. And the problem about this whole thing and why people talk about rare earth elements now is because way back in 1950, you know how many metric tons of these elements, these metals, basically, how many were used? Zero. It wasn't until the invention of the color TV that rare earths became very desirable, basically, and necessary to develop the red, green, and blue of the television screen. And so as we've progressed as far as technology is concerned, the demand has really increased. Just every time you look at a computer screen, you can see it because of rare earth elements. When you look at your watch, when you look at your iPhone or your Android device or your dashboard on modern cars, when you think about drive-by-wire, I'm sure you think a lot about that, but that's where in the old days you would put your foot on the gas pedal and there was metal linkage that was connected to the carburetor and had different joints in it and stuff, but eventually got to the carburetor where when you push the gas, it would make your car go faster. And so we don't do that much anymore. Just about every car is not drive-by-wire, but at least accelerate-by-wire. When you put your foot on the gas pedal, there's no linkage pressing on the carburetor because there's no carburetor. It's fuel injection. It's all done by wires. And that all of that technology is made available to us because of the way that rare earth elements are used. Now today, 250,000 metric tons are basically used in this country every year of rare earth elements. Now the vast majority of these are used as catalysts, which means that they, when combined with other things, they become something else that is useful to us. They are critical in certain applications, such as in your catalytic converter, in order to be able to convert nasty-smelling stuff into stuff that is less so and coming out the tailpipe. Isn't that a scientific explanation? Aren't you proud? 6% are used in the making of ceramics and glass. 5% are used in glass polishing. 4% are used in different kinds of metallurgy, and then another 10% are used for other purposes, but very vital purposes. For example, there are several pounds of rare earth compounds in batteries that power every electric vehicle and every hybrid electric vehicle. And as, you know, as we move towards more energy independence and all these worries about climate change and all this other stuff, governments are going to be pushing electric vehicles, and then the demand for rare earths will become even greater. And here's a few examples of stuff that these rare earths go into. Lanthanum is essential for night vision goggles, which I don't have. I'm not sure what Tara did with my pair of night vision goggles. I may have to borrow some. Neodymium, whatever. Laser range finders, guidance systems, and communications. Europium, now that's easy to say. Fluorescents and phosphors in lamps and monitors. So that would be like the fluorescence in your watch. Anything that shines and that creates a light from a electronic source somewhere. Erbium is used in amplifiers and fiber optic data transmission. A lot of fiber optics being used. We wired our entire Nissan building when it came to communication for our computers with fiber optics. And we are connected to a fiber optic cable that runs along down the Allegheny Bypass here in Greenville, Tennessee, so that we could transmit information faster. Samarium is used in permanent magnets that are stable at very high temperatures. It's also used in precision-guided weapons and in white noise production in stealth technology. So, just in case you want to buy some samarium, at least you know now what you can use it for. Now, some of these elements are not quite as rare as the name applies. Thallium and lutetium are two of the least abundant rare earth elements, but they each have an annual or an average abundance that is nearly 200 times greater than the abundance of gold, for example. However, what makes these qualifies rare is they are very difficult to mine. Because it's very unusual to find them in any concentrations that are high enough for any kind of economical extraction. The most abundant rare earth elements are similar to commonly used industrial metals such as chromium, nickel, zinc, tin, tungsten, even lead. They are all rarely found in any kind of extractable concentrations, and so that's what makes them rare. I guess if it was hard to get to nickel and zinc, they would be considered rare earths as well. But before 1965, there was really very little demand for rare earth elements. Most of the world's supply actually came from deposits in India and Brazil, and in the 1950s, South Africa became a leading producer of rare earths. At the time, the biggest mine in the United States was called the Mountain Pass Mine in California, and it was producing, minor amounts, and then all of a sudden, color TVs started coming online, and europium is one of the rare earths that is the most essential material for producing color images, and the Mountain Pass Mine began producing that, and it would become the largest rare earth producer in the world, and placed the United States as a leading producer. And then China came into the picture, and in the early 80s, they became the world's leading producer. And through the 90s and 2000s, China has strategically strengthened their hold on this and started really dropping their prices. So they were pricing the domestic mines out of business. So I guess when you don't have to pay people to work in your mines, you can price your product a whole lot less. And plus, they have the biggest reserves of anybody out of the 120 million metric tons that are out there. China controls 44 million metric tons. United States is 1.5 million, so we're way behind. Brazil is one of the, I think they're the next biggest. And then Vietnam, as little as that place is, they have a big reserve. India has about 6.9 million metric tons. So since vehicles, batteries, the demand for consumer electronics, energy-efficient lighting, all different types of catalysts are going to be in greater demand. over the next decade. So this is going to be an issue, and as you know, the demand for rechargeable batteries is also impacted by this. So new developments in medical technology are going to increase. Surgical lasers, magnetic resonance imaging, the MRI, all of this is dependent upon the availability of rare earth metals, and not the least of which are your Hyundai Elantra. So it's probably dependent on it as well. So we shall see how this proceeds, and we'll take our first break and be back here in just a minute. Okay, I'm back. Again, Lenny Lawson here, the car guru, and if you're a new listener, somebody who is maybe driving through this area, or somebody has said, hey, you need to listen to that Lenny Lawson dude. He's a car guru, and he knows stuff. Then I'm glad you're listening, because hopefully you can learn something about buying, selling, trading, getting your car serviced, handling situations that have gotten a little out of control, you know, like when you can't get your car fixed. We've got a dealer in the area, not too far from here, that is the same franchise dealer that we are, but whenever he needs to work on a transmission, you know where he sends it? He sends it to Gateway. And we don't necessarily like that because it's all warranty work, but we're always excited to gain a new customer if that's the end result. But sometimes, you know, if somebody sells you a car, they should be able to fix it, right? But there are such high training standards that sometimes they can't meet them. And they have to hire a tech away from somebody else who has passed all of the tests and is able to get warranty work paid for. Because if you have a tech working on a car that they are not certified to work on, you can't get paid for that as a dealer. And the factory, Ford in my case, pays the bills when it comes to warranty work. But I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about old antique cars. You know, you got to be careful sometimes when you buy something. You got to know what you're looking for, and sometimes even when you know what you're looking for, you miss it. I had some good friends in Kingsport that had an old car they wanted to sell. It's an old Mustang, and I was excited about it. It was a 66, I think, convertible Mustang. Not a well-equipped car, but a 289 with, I mean, the original 289 with an automatic transmission, power top. So it wasn't a loaded-up Mustang. It was something that Ford sold a lot of, and they gave me the opportunity to come up and check it out. And I had my grandson with me at the time, and that was somewhat of a distraction. Not that I would have found out anything more had he not been there, but I was more interested in him than in the car. So anyway, we ended up putting a deal together, and I bought the Mustang and brought it back. And as soon as I got it back, I posted it on Facebook, and within 30 minutes, I had a buyer. And he's also a friend of mine, and he said, don't sell the car to anybody else. We'll be back in town on Monday, and we want to buy the car, so hold it for us. And I said, I'll hold it for you, not a problem. Well, in the meantime, I had some guys down at Ricky Parton's shop, and also my guys, they put it up on a lift, and then the full story started to reveal itself. It had some rust issues, and folks, that's going to happen. Get a car that sits outside, especially 1960s, 1970s metal, it's going to rust. Gosh, I see so much of that when I'm out riding my bike or riding around in a car with my wife in the county. I see these old cars that have some value or would have some value if they weren't sitting out in the field or underneath a carport even. But this is what happens. So anyway, I posted it on Facebook. They said they wanted the car. They came in on Monday. I told them what basically it was going to be. We priced it, and everything's good. We'll take the car. So I had some things to do to it. I was going to put wheels and tires, and there were some other things that need to be addressed. I was going to clean it up, detail it for them. Well, when they put it on the lift, lots of rust. Structural rust, which means that potentially hit a really hard bump, the car breaks in half. Maybe not quite that bad, but dangerously rusted. So, had to replace the entire chassis. I called my buddy. I said, well, I got good news and bad news. What's the bad news? I said, well, we got a lot of rust. Well, what's the good news? Well, we can fix it. He said, how much? I told him. He said, fix it. So, obviously, he wanted the car. Not too long after that, we pulled the valve cover off. I wanted to paint the valve covers, make the engine look pretty. Oh, boy. Pulled the valve cover off, and the valve, the actual engine, all the valves were just completely covered with gunk. And that's understandable as well. You know, when people buy cars and don't use them, don't drive them, don't service them regularly, that's going to happen. And so we were able to come up with a plan to fix the engine. I found out what it was going to cost. I called the guy who bought it. I said, I got good news and bad news. Same scenario. And the same result. He said, just go ahead and do it. So I have a very trusting friend who is can't wait to get his Mustang. Now, when it's all said and done, when you look at this project, you want to be able to make sure that you're going to be able to come out of it on the end. Well, what is the end? What is the end game? I mean, are you just buying this old antique car to just drive around and to enjoy on weekends and stuff like that? Are you wanting to turn it into a show car and win awards, win like an Antique Automobile Club of America award, maybe go show it at Hershey, Pennsylvania, or one of the other big judged meets is what they call them, to actually win an award? I've done that several times with cars that we restored, but the cars have to be ultra original. I mean, you can't even have the wrong clamps on the radiator hose. They'll knock you for that and actually knock you out of the running for an award. So is that what you want to do? Or do you want to flip it? I mean, are you doing it to make money? Well, you better have control of your costs and you better know what the market is before you do that. Now, the good thing about this Mustang is they are skyrocketing in value. I bought a 1966 Fastback Mustang about 2 years ago, and it was a four-speed car, 289. I think it was a A-code car, which was a four-barrel carburetor. It was a good performer, fastback, 2+2. Only had 16,000 miles on it. I paid $25,000 for the car, which was low, and ended up selling it for $40,000 not too long thereafter. So it did really well on that car. I sold it to a guy in Canada. I wish I had it back. That was maybe a year ago when I sold the car for $40,000 to the guy in Canada. I've since called him to see if I could buy it back. He didn't want to sell it back. Today, that car is worth between $60,000 and $65,000, maybe $70,000. The Mustang market has exploded. Not the coupes, though. If you have a regular Mustang coupe from 64, 65, 66, they're just not worth a lot of money unless they're absolutely pristine and have a lot of rare options on them. Convertibles are worth more. But the fastbacks is where the money is right now. So, this was a fun experience for me. I mean, I think about the folks who sold it to me. I love them to death, and it's not, there's no issue because they didn't know. They expressed the fact that they were glad that I bought it and that they didn't take on that project because it would have been alarming. Imagine you buy a car and you expect to drive it and you're driving it down the road. And it gets hot, and then all of a sudden it starts smoking, or it stops. And you thought, when you bought it, sounded good, started good. That's the way this car was. You would have never known that it had severe engine trouble until you drove it for a long enough distance for it to get hot. And then it would probably stop running. So these are the things that you run into when you're buying older cars. If you don't know anything about cars before you buy it, you need to have it inspected. And by somebody who's really doing a thorough inspection. And I mean, not just laying on the ground looking underneath it, but put it up on a lift where you can actually see with a flashlight what's going on. Also, check the engine thoroughly. Pull the valve covers off, pull the oil pan off, and look at the condition of the crankshaft. And the oil condition is important. There's just so many things that you need to look at before you buy a car, especially if you're paying anywhere close to market value. And you need to know what that market value is. If you go to Hagerty.com, there is a valuation tool that they have. And you'll need to log in. You'll need to put in a username and a password and so forth and register. But it's a good resource if you like old cars and you want to know what they're worth. If you don't care, then, call the guru. But if you do care, it might be something that you own an old car. You want to see what it's worth. But you still have to be able to classify a car properly, based on their scale, because they use a scale of, Concour and then excellent, good, fair, poor, and so forth. And it basically is a useful tool to people who know how to evaluate a car and what that means. Just because a car is pretty and it's got shiny paint does not mean that it is a Concour car. There's a lot of different factors in those kind of things. So they give you a guide and a way to interpret all of that stuff. Definitions are pretty clear. and it's a guide to go by. But there are other resources, such as Bring a Trailer Auction. You know, you can go back and look at past results on that, or you can, you know, call me, and I'll be glad to do the research for you. Anyway, my cell phone is 423-552-2020. If you ever have any questions about any of that kind of stuff, then don't hesitate to call, and we'll be back in just a minute. So I know the people that sold me that car are probably listening, so I just want to know that I am going to be suing them for fraud in the near future. They should be receiving a knock on the door even as we speak. No, I'm just kidding. I would never do that. And I am so happy to have them as customers and friends. And also, it's not the first car that I have purchased from them. And I'm hoping that they will keep their eyes out for a fastback Mustang. I think he wants the same thing I do. But he'll probably give me a first shot at it because he owes me now, right? Well, folks, thanks for listening, and we hope that you tune in tomorrow for another edition of My Car Guru. And you, again, call me anytime you need me. I'm here to help you make good decisions buying, selling, trading, or servicing your car. Thanks again.